Fourth? This is the fourth in a series that we've been calling Tales Told in Context. This one refers to probably the most familiar of all of the stories that I've dealt with this week. I suspect many of you already know it, called Ragman. I'm going to indulge myself first, and then I will indulge you. What I mean is that I hope I will be done soon enough this time so that we can, if you have any questions or responses, finally, or any dialogue, that we'll have some chance for that kind of back and forthing. I say very carefully that I'm going to indulge myself first, though, because I'm going to give you the context of the writing of this story, Ragman. It is a kind of a self-indulgence. I want to make that kind of clear here at first. There are some pieces of art, in fact, this is what the artist hopes for anyway, which detach from the artist and from the times in which they were written. They take on a life of their own, and then they travel far and wide, totally in their own life. And they take up dwelling in every single place where they are read or where people hear them being read, so forth and so on. This is what's happened to Ragman, and I'm grateful for it, because that it finally, Ragman is no longer my story, because I wrote it. It has nothing to do with whether I have it in possession or not. This is a surprise to me. I had not expected nor even intended for this story to become the possession of the public, which it is. But because it is, I must tell you here in the last lecture when we're talking about context, that finally the real context of every art, piece of art, every piece of literature when it works, is the context in which you discover it. That's very important. Finally, it is the context in which you discover it. And if it was a friend of yours who read you a certain poem, the context of that poem is your friendship and your friend's voice and the feelings that you had at that particular moment. And that's a righteous and rightful context. If that poem moved you when you heard it then, it is not necessary, I tell you now, fourth day, I wouldn't have told you this the first day, it is not necessary to go back to the author and say, what did you mean when you wrote it? It isn't necessary to go back to the author's time and say, how did you feel? What was going on? What was happening for you when you wrote it? I really think it is the characteristic of art itself to detach, just like that, and then to constantly find new life every time it meets living beings again. And when that happens, the artist is a little bit sad and also very grateful. Sad because, in fact, then it really is everybody's piece of work thereafter. It really is. When people interpret my material and they discover by their interpretation stuff in my books that I didn't know was there, so long as they keep to the principles, to good principles of interpretation, they absolutely have a right to that discovery. And sometimes talking to people, I find out more than I knew was in there. I mean, I know an awful lot of what I do. You have to be a craftsperson when you're working with art. You have to be making wise choices. But when it works and when it finds its own life in each context, then it will be rejuvenated or revived, reinterpreted, and new each time. And then it isn't mine anymore. I think Ragman is a piece like that. That's why my talking about it today is really a self-indulgence. My guess is that many of you have already read it or heard it, and in fact, I'm going to read it when I come to you. I want to keep the words exactly as they are, and so this time I'm not going to so much tell and jump around. I'm going to read it. It's an indulgence, too, because for me it's kind of good to go back and look at from whence spring things like this. And I ask you, after I tell you what brought this story about, no, I don't ask you, I just say, you can forget. You can forget what I tell you. That's all right. It may be nice to know, but it's no nicer than a footnote. And finally, that's what we ought to recognize, huh? I mean, this whole week I've been giving you nothing more than footnotes to pieces of art. If we had a lot of time, we could talk about artistic interpretation. That's what I'm telling you about. Sometimes in graduate school, they work very, very hard to get back to form criticism, first principles, Sitz im Leben, historical critical method, so forth and so on. And finally, it's the child that picks up the piece and laughs who has interpreted that piece the best. Okay? And so we have that freedom. I give you these things merely as a self-indulgence. But I begin by telling you that Ragman was an occasional piece. It's another fancy word. I do this at the beginning so that you feel like there's some substance to this stuff. Occasional pieces means that they were written for an occasion, that they were not necessarily written for universal consumption. When I first wrote Ragman, I never thought that it would have a life beyond Grace Lutheran Church. In fact, I wrote it first for the newsletter. And it was in the Easter newsletter several years back, many years back. And as often happened with that stuff, which is occasional, which has its purpose and its being right there in that relationship, I didn't think of it then, thereafter, until I was at a seminary and somebody told me that they were using it in their homiletics class. And that was, I think, about a year later, which was a surprise to me, but I guess because we sent our newsletter out, somebody hooked onto that, and I said, Then I went and back looked at it as a reader instead of the writer, and I said, oh, well. And thought it was good enough, and I printed it in my column. And there was a response, and then I put it into a magazine. And now I'm going to sound very mercenary to you. After it was in the magazine, as I traveled the country, I began to hear all kinds of people who knew Ragman because of that magazine. And here, after all my high-flown phrases about letting art go, I thought, hey, I want to put my name on that thing. And so I said, I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to put it in the first part of that book. First of all, I'm going to call the book Ragman. And then they'll know. So there's all kinds of stuff going on. But it was an occasional piece first, and I'm going to set up for you simply what the occasion was. I'm going to tell you about a woman who I'm going to call Tandy. That's not her name. But I'll call her Tandy. When I wrote Ragman for Easter, this is how it fits with Luke 24 and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I thought of Tandy. I thought of many people at Grace, in Grace Congregation. But I can tell you truly that among those people, I also thought of Tandy. She's the one who's going to be the context and who was a part of a whole concept, which was a context for the writing of this thing. Now, I need to set up, before I tell you about Tandy, I don't want you should blame her. I mean that seriously. When I tell you about Tandy, you ought not to blame her, or as it says in Death of a Salesman, you dastn't blame this woman. You dastn't blame this woman. And so I need to set up the circumstance, which may not seem to you strange. Maybe you've recognized some of these circumstances in your own situations, your own churches. The circumstance into which Tandy came was Grace Church early on. Churches which think sometimes that they are very inviting and very kind and very warm are sometimes unaware of the fact that they are to the outside world forbidding, enclosed, indifferent, careless. Their warmth, as they see it, really is the warmth from one person to another within that particular kind of congregation. Their warmth is perhaps the warmth that they have received from people that they have worshipped with over the years. But to people outside of a congregation, they may not necessarily look warm. Grace Church, as beautiful as those people are, and as dearly as I love them, at certain times did not necessarily look warm. I don't know how common this is in your churches, but in our church, it was the custom that people had their own pews to sit in. Their very own pews. And sometimes they were very, very kind about the fact that the stranger was sitting in their pew. But they made it very clear that that stranger wasn't quite in exactly the right place, which from the beginning is a discomfort for worship. And as we got more and more people coming in our congregation, I would see people come to their pews and there'd be filled. One lady, whose first name is Ada, when she would come upon a full pew, which was hers for years and years, would circle like a satellite in the aisle. She was lost because something of this tradition had been broken. There was another time when there was a woman, I can use her name, Karen McGann, a white woman, came to our church, and she's now a member of the church. But the very first time she came to the church, this predates her Christianity. It was even before she was a Christian. She came to the early service. She came so early, half an hour before service, that there was nobody else in the entire church. She took up a seat, second pew from the back on the left-hand side. She sat about 4 inches from the wall. The next person who came in was Rosemary Smith, whose seat that was. There was nobody else in the whole church. And Rosemary Smith went right up to Karen McGann. They had never met before. Went past her knees and squeezed down into 4 inches. To this day, Karen McGann says, I thought that was the friendliest church in the world. Well, to her, it was friendly. To Tandy, it was not necessarily. Grace, in that particular community, was the only black Lutheran church. It was made up of many, many teachers, which were the professionals of our community. There was AME, there was CME, there was Southern Baptist, there was Missionary Baptist, there were all kinds of black congregations around. But Grace is the only black Lutheran church. It did not have a good reputation 10, 15 years ago because of that. People used to think of it. It's really strange when you hear the neighborhood talk, then you get a sense of what they thought that congregation was like. They used to have the choir at Grace sing to the left of the chancel in a little room that opened onto the chancel. The people in the neighborhood used to walk around and saying, people at Grace think they're the angels. Think they're not worthy to be seen when they sing. Like that. So our reputation was not great. We were hinkty. We were a hinkty church. We were uppity. We were an uppity church. And people were scared to kind of come into that church. This is what Tandy meant. This is the sort of thing Tandy meant. I want to tell you also, as I want to continue to sketch this scene. A Reverend J.D. Marks, Missionary Baptist pastor, once thought he was being exceedingly kind to me, and he described to me how he thought Grace was. He made a distinction. He and I sat in his car after a funeral outside of Grace. This is just when I had begun. He said what was not true about our congregation. J.D. Marks was not correct. And he wasn't even clear on what the neighborhood thought, but he wasn't far away from some of the people in the neighborhood. And this is what Tandy felt she was coming into. J.D. Marks said that there's always a blue vein church. That was his term, a blue vein church. And what he meant was that it was a black church of mixed blood, blood mixed enough that the veins would show blue through the flesh. He said this with some scorn. He said this with contempt. He said this is a leftover phenomenon from the days of slavery when you had the blacks who worked in the field and the blacks who worked in the house. Those who worked in the house, he said, looked with scorn and pride down upon those who worked in the field. Those who worked in the field, he said, were independent and made their lives on their own. But those who worked in the house hung upon their white masters and mistresses. And there came the mixed blood. Now, this is J.D. Marx's own theory, but he was indicating something of the standoffishness that the people of the neighborhood felt toward Grace, because he said, there are now churches like the house blacks, that's not the word that he used, like the house blacks. Churches, he said, who find themselves in a mainline tradition in order to use the money of the mainline and look down upon the Baptist churches that make it on their own. J.D. Marx was flat wrong. He was wrong. Grace existed totally on its own independent income. And they were not hinkty and proud. They were humble. But this was the reputation that they had for a while in the neighborhood. For a while. Why? I can understand it. Because we preached different. We sang different. We stood up and sat down at odd times. Because people in our church did not say amen every time they wanted to. You understand? That all looks hinkty. That all looks kind of proud. Because we had a liturgy where they had a follow in the book. And because at that time we were using the old blue hymnal, we sang so slow it was like a dirge. It was like we were going to a funeral every Sunday. I push it. That was what Tandy came to. And yet Tandy came. You dasn't blame her. That was boldness on her part. One more thing. The pastor was not all that great either. It seems to me that we show our true characters when we get caught in situations where we act spontaneously, when we can't keep our mask on, when the mask slips. And people like Tandy, I think, see past that mask even when it's not slipping. It's just that we don't always see past that mask. I generally thought I was a kind person. I generally thought I was a giving and forgiving person, that I was an open, inclusive pastor in every sense of that word. But I wasn't always. And I recognized it one Thursday night. Building up to Tandy. She wasn't in this story. It was a thief in this story. It's Thursday night, late, 9:30, nearing the end of teaching an adult Bible class, confirmation class. It was a spring storm. Horrible spring storm broke over Grace. It rained hard, and it thundered and it lightninged, and I thought we better let out early, because when I looked outside, Grace is up on a kind of a hill, and here comes Elliot, and there goes Gum, and Elliot and Gum were water pools. They were just filled with water, and the lightning was crackling in the sky. People's cars looked like they might float away, so we left off early, and we went out and helped push people through the water. It was up to here. We don't have a great sewer system where we are. Every time it rains, you can swim. It's just the way it is. We helped everyone get away that night except Lucian Snaden, who had to wait for his mother. Lucian was as fully as tall as I am. He's a very, very quiet gentleman. We stood outside in a break in the rain while the lightning flashed on the front grass, waiting for his mother to come. Now, while we stood out there, I heard on the other side of the church, between the church and the old parsonage, I heard glass break, shattering glass. My first thought is, it's the wind, because there was a strong wind and because the lightning was flashing. I told Lucian, stay here, I'm going to go check that. I went around the church, and when I came between the church and the parsonage, there standing on a little porch with broken glass all around him was a thief. 9:30 in the evening was a thief standing there, and the lights were blazing in the church. Now, this was the third time in a row that this had happened to us, the very same window, and I became furious. I couldn't control my anger. This is now the spontaneous thing that reveals something about myself. I said, what are you doing? I shouted like that, and he went, click. I don't know what was the matter. I mean, I was mad at him also because he was a foolish thief. You could check to see if the pastor's on the other side of the church before you're going to break in and steal the typewriter. You can look and see that all the lights are blazing. Wait till the storm is over. Any of those things. I said, what are you doing? And he froze. I said, you wait there. I was mad. I really was. And the lightning flashed, and I saw his face, and it was a terrified face. It wasn't an old fellow. I'd say it was upper teens, lower 20s, whatever. And he didn't wait. He didn't wait. He turned, and he ran off that porch, and he started running down the grass toward Gum Street, which is full of water. I shouted, wait, at him like that, and his legs went, whoop, and he fell down on his face in the grass. And I came up behind him, and just as I came, he squirted out from my arms like a frog, doom, like that. And he ran again. He was so scared. When he got to the edge where the grass went down into the water, he slipped and fell on his back, and I was on him instantly. I had my hand on his chest, and I was staring into his eyes, and now I had a problem. Well, these things flashed through my mind. Should I call the cops? If I call the cops, I have to wait with this guy, this sucker, this foolish thief, till the cops come and then all that stuff. Or should I just be kind to him? This is what I did. It was perfectly irrational, but it showed who I was. The lightning flashed. And I said, this is the truth. I said, you don't ever come back here again. And the lightning flashed. And I said, that's God. That's God, and God says, you'll never come back here again. The guy's eyes went huge like boiled eggs. I'm the preacher. And up he got in his legs. He went. It wasn't only Peter walked on water. Soon he got out of there. Now, there's the truth. I called the wrath of God down upon me. I called forked lightning down upon me. And what's even worse is that when that guy took off, it dawned on me he was bigger than me. It dawned on me, and I walked back around to Lucian. Like this. Oh, I was so full of pride. I stood right next to him. Hey, Lucian, you know what just happened? Of course, Lucian is Saturday. Lucian never cracks. He cracks this much of a smile. That's all I got. Now, maybe you see through this story. Maybe you do. This was not a kindness in my part. I mean, I used the cloth, and I used it in that kind of a neighborhood where lightning and preacher and all that kind of stuff is given an inordinate kind of authority. I used the cloth in a wrong way, in a deadly way, and in a scare-you-off kind of a way, and that was spontaneous in my part. I did not know that I had that in me, but I think people like Tandy can see that. Don't you know? Don't you know? Tandy is street. Tandy was street. That didn't mean she lived in the street. I do not mean, now we have to be careful with these words. That did not mean that she didn't have a place in which to live. It didn't mean that she was a street dweller. But it means she was street smart. And street smart sees right through that. Street smart sees through the masks that we put up and that everybody in a parish can't. And that's what I think maybe Tandy saw, although I didn't know that. Tandy asked me a question over and over again, and she intensified the question. I don't think she did it on purpose. It just happened between the two of us. And she intensified the question by revealing a little bit more of her life each time. Ragman was finally my response in a kind of a desperation. The first time I remember Tandy in church, she came with her kid. Her kid's name was Stink. She called him Stink. That wasn't, I mean, he had another name, but that was what she called him. And Stinky didn't know about worship. I'm it's going to sound to you like I'm exaggerating, and perhaps I am a little bit exaggerating, but not a whole lot. The first time that I was aware that Stink was in church was when Tandy was sitting about halfway back, and Stink, it looked to me, in the middle of my sermon, projected himself from her lap up into the air, flew through the air, and landed on a belly flop in the aisle. This is Stink. Then he swam the aisle. And he made noise. He was a nearly uncontrollable child, was Stinky. And after church was the first time Tandy asked me that question as she was going out. She said, and I remember all I told you about what people thought. She said, is there a place here for me? Something like that. Is there a place here for me? And I think she was thinking of Stinky. And I said, sure there is, Tandy. Sure there is. Sure. And I thought she meant like clothing and so forth and so on. And by that time, now this is a big thing. By that time, women were wearing pants to church. That was a big step for us. And people were being more and more casual, and there were no ties and so forth and so on. I said, sure there is, Tandy. You can dress as you please. I don't think she believed me. Sometime later, she came back again. She was off and on in church, but she always seemed to come to me with problems that I could not solve. It's the truth. She came to me, and she had enormous sunglasses on, huge sunglasses. Tandy is thin. She has high cheekbones. She's light-colored. I think that she's good-looking. I think she's a little thinner than she needs to be. She came alone this time, and when we were sitting, she was really looking, I think, for something from me, and I wasn't sure what during our conversation till that last question again. She took off her glasses, and she had ruptured blood vessels around her eye, and it was dark and it was red, both. It was a red and dark bruise all around. And I said, Tandy, what is that? And she said, a man beats me. And then I found out how Tandy lived. The man she was living with was not the father of Stink. Somebody else was the father of Stink. The man she was living with, she wasn't married to. But she had to live with someone. And when they started living together, she said, we were mad, passionate, in love, she said. But now he beat her. And this is a horrible welt that was on her face. And I'm sitting there thinking, and I know the guy, all right? I know the guy she lives with. And this guy is bigger than me. I mean, he is much bigger than me, and there's no way that I can go to this guy. Powerful arms. And the guy held on a job. He brought money in. Never was late to work. Always did go to work. But at home, he would beat Tandy sometimes. She messed up. Of course, Tandy had a sharp tongue. Tandy had a tongue like a razor, and she would use it when she got mad. I mean, that was her fighting. Some fought with fists, some fought with the tongue. And I didn't know what to do for Tandy at that point. And then I wasn't aware, but it was what she ended up with, you know. And after I found out all of how she lived, and here she is sitting in my little tiny office, Grace Lutheran Church, Church of the Teachers, full of angels, too good to be seen, she said, is there a place for me here? You got a place for me? I said, Tandy, yes, there's a place for you here. Of course there's a place for you here. Jesus, I think, I said, loves you. Well, and I wouldn't see Tandy again for a while. And then this is finally it. And this was the final question where I needed somehow to tell Tandy that there was a place for her. And I needed to say it in a way where it just wasn't me trying to persuade her with all my foolishness and all my sinfulness. Persuade her of, I think, the presence of Jesus Christ, as Dad was talking about this morning. She came again, and she was crying. She didn't cry over that welt, all right? But she is crying. Now, this is true. And she said, she leaned to me, and these are problems insoluble, I tell you. She said, I might have the VD. And I said, that's the problem. And she goes, oh, no, that's not the problem. She could handle that and get shots. She said, I've been down to the welfare. I said, is that the problem? You want somebody to go with you? She said, no, that's not the problem. She said, the problem is that they wanted to know all the men I've been with. I said, you can't remember? She said, no, she could remember. She said, the problem is that they're going to call this fellow that she lives with. And she knows that she didn't get it from him, and she'd been fooling around elsewhere. And this is the problem. When the welfare calls him, he will know what she's been doing, and he's really going to beat her within an inch of her life. That's the problem. Now that sounds very complicated. It is so complicated that I didn't know what to do. God's grace is that the welfare never did call him, and she finally left, detached from that fellow, went out with a sting elsewhere. Not left the town. She's still there. But she ended that. And this is like all the stuff that she brought me always focused on this issue. And I don't think she did this consciously. And now you know why I begin. I say, you dastn't blame this woman. This woman was a survivor under extraordinarily difficult conditions. And I think that she was profoundly brave because she kept coming back into this teacher church, this grace church. And she again said, is there a place for me? I belong here? And I think that's part of what it was about, persistently, persistently. And so I won, and I always said, yes, yes, there is. And I would touch her, I would talk to her. But I needed to do it in the terms of her experience. Do you understand? And I needed to do it almost a little bit separated from me. And Tandy was in my mind when I wrote this story then. I needed for her to see that the Jesus that was at Grace Church or any other place was not simply bound to blue eyes, was not simply bound to upper class, was not simply bound to being a teacher of other people, but that this particular Jesus was one who was utterly present for her as well as for everybody else, and was as easy being present for her as being present for anybody else of any other strata of society. That's what I had in mind when I wrote Ragman. I had Tandy, and Tandy needed to know this. I read it for you. I saw a strange sight. I stumbled upon a story most strange, like nothing my life, my street sense, my sly tongue ever prepared me for. Hush, child. Hush, Tandy. Hush now, and I will tell it to you. Even before the dawn one Friday morning, I noticed a young man, handsome and strong, walking the alleys of our city. He was pulling an old cart filled with clothes, both bright and new, and he was calling in a clear tenor voice, "Rags!" Oh, the air was foul and the first light filthy to be crossed by such sweet music. "Rags! New rags for old, I take your tired rags. Rags!" Now this is a wonder, I thought to myself. For the man stood 6'4", and his arms were like tree limbs, hard and muscular, and his eyes flashed intelligence. Couldn't he find a better job than this, to be a ragman in the inner city? And you must understand, this ragman is walking down Gum and is about to turn down the alley that goes from Gum all the way down to Washington. I followed him. My curiosity drove me, and I wasn't disappointed. Soon the ragman saw a woman sitting on her back porch. She was sobbing into a handkerchief, sighing and shedding a thousand tears. Her knees and her elbows made a sad X. Her shoulders shook. Her heart was breaking. The ragman stopped his cart. Quietly, he walked to the woman, stepping round tin cans, dead toys, and Pampers. "Give me your rag," he said so gently, "and I'll give you another." He slipped the handkerchief from her eyes. She looked up, and he laid across her palm a linen cloth so clean and new that it shined. She blinked from the gift to the giver. Then, as he began to pull his cart again, the ragman did a strange thing. He put her stained handkerchief to his own face. And then he began to weep, to sob as grievously as she had done, his shoulders shaking. Yet she was left without a tear. This is a wonder, I breathed to myself. And I followed the sobbing ragman like a child who cannot turn away from a mystery. "Rags! Rags! New rags for old, in a little while when the sky showed gray behind the rooftops, and I could see the shredded curtains hanging out black windows, the ragman came upon a girl child whose head was wrapped in a bandage, whose eyes were empty. Blood soaked her bandage. A single line of blood ran down her cheek. Now the tall ragman looked upon this child with pity, and he drew a lovely yellow bonnet from his cart. "Give me your rag," he said, tracing his own line on her cheek, "and I'll give you mine." The child could only gaze at him while he loosened the bandage, removed it, and tied it to his own head. The bonnet he set on hers, and I gasped at what I saw, for with the bandage went the wound. Against his brow it ran a darker, more substantial blood. It was his own. "Rags, I take old. Rags," cried the sobbing, bleeding, strong, intelligent ragman. Now the sun hurt both the sky and my eyes. The ragman seemed more and more to hurry. "Are you going to work?" he said to a man who leaned against a telephone pole. The man shook his head. The ragman pressed him. "Do you have a job?" "Are you crazy?" sneered the other. He pulled away from the pole, revealing the right sleeve of his jacket. It was flat, the cuff stuffed into the pocket. He had no arm. "So," said the ragman, "give me your jacket and I'll give you mine." Such quiet authority in his voice. The one-armed man took off his jacket, so did the ragman, and I trembled at what I saw, for the ragman's arm stayed in its sleeve, and when the other put it on, he had two good arms, thick as tree limbs, but the ragman had only one. "Go to work," he said. After that, he found a drunk lying unconscious beneath an army blanket, an old man, hunched, wizened, and sick. He took that blanket and wrapped it round himself, but for the drunk, he left new clothes. And now I had to run to keep up with the ragman, though he was weeping uncontrollably and bleeding freely at the forehead, pulling his cart with one arm, stumbling for drunkenness, falling again and again, exhausted, old, and sick, yet he went with terrible speed. On spider's legs, he skittered through the alleys of the city, this mile and the next, until he came to its limits, and then he rushed beyond. I wept to see the change in this man. I hurt to see his sorrow, and yet I needed to see where he was going in such haste, perhaps to know what drove him so. The little old ragman. He came to a landfill. He came to the garbage pits. And then I wanted to help him in what he did, but I hung back, hiding. He climbed a hill. With tormented labor, he cleared a little space on that hill. Then he sighed. He lay down. He pillowed his head on a handkerchief and a jacket. He covered his bones with an old army blanket. And he died. Oh, how I cried to witness that death. I slumped in a junked car and wailed and mourned as one who has no hope. Because I had come to love the ragman. Every other face had faded in the wonder of this man, and I cherished him, but he died. He died. And I sobbed myself to sleep. I did not know, how could I know, that I slept through Friday night and Saturday and its night too. But then on Sunday morning, I was wakened by a violence. Light. Pure, hard, demanding light slammed against my sour face, and I blinked, and I looked, and I saw the last and the first wonder of all. There was the ragman, folding the blanket most carefully, a scar on his forehead, but alive, and besides that, healthy. There was no sign of sorrow nor of age, and all the rags that he had gathered shined for cleanliness. Well, then I lowered my head, and, trembling for all that I had seen, I myself walked up to the ragman. I told him my name with shame, for I was a sorry figure next to him. Then I took off all my clothes in that place, and I said to him with dear yearning in my voice, "Dress me." He dressed me. My Lord, he put new rags on me, and I am a wonder beside him. The ragman the ragman, the Christ. And now I said that if you have any questions, I could indulge you about anything that has happened or anything that has been said during this week. And if you have no questions, that's all right, too. It's a marvelous thing when people have no questions.
We're glad you're out there. Circulating.
Did your thief come back again?
Pardon?
Did your thief come back to the church?
I don't know. I never did see. We did have another break in time since then, and that's not unusual. That face.
I think
face,
I'm going to come back the next Sunday. Worship there forever.
Yeah.
You referred to Bettelheim's book earlier, Paul, and he writes about, and this is the Fool Tales.
Yes.
Do you use those too?
Yes.
Or why do you write so many of your own new stories?
That's a nice question. That really is. Yes, I would use folk tales. Yes, I do use them, especially when they fit. One of the finest, I think, for unconditional love is The Beauty and the Beast. Now, that's not quite a folk tale because we know the woman who was the author of that tale. We know who she was. And yet, it's very much like folk tale and stuff like that. I've used Greek myths when they fit. And I promise you, the kids follow that stuff, and then you may have to undo it. Why I write, however, I mean, you may have to explain sometimes to the kids and work it too. I will sometimes tell a story alone, but I will very often walk them through the story as well, on my arm, okay? But why I write partly is because I can, and partly because I think that the church has only so and so many sources of stories. The scripture is our most profound and our substantial, our foundational source of story, and we must go back to that again and again and tell it. But besides that, I think we have this community of faith which shares and gives stories to one another. And it seems to me that that's part of what my job is. My job is to feed the community of faith with stories. So it's kind of a double thing when I do it in ministry. One is that it is occasional, and sometimes that's the easiest and the best response. I mean, you know, there's one thing to go and try to find the exact right story. That's hard to do. And the other thing is to make up the exact right story. That's sometimes a little easier to do. So for myself, I would do it. But also with the sense that it is also a ministry and that it goes to the community of faith that it may be used generally. That's a very brief answer for what really is a question about my profession. Why do I do what I do? Yeah.
Do those, like a story like this, would you use this as a sermon at a time, or do these stories, do you share those with your congregation in a more, some other way? Or would you write a story?
Yes, I would. The story Lily that I told was a sermon first, the story on Monday. Other stories were written down for Ragman was first written, and it had its occasion for the eyes, I thought. And in fact, I never did. That's one reason why I read it today instead of telling it. I have never really told that story. And I found everybody else in the world was doing it, and I thought I'd catch up. So yes, I will for sermons. Yes, I will. But I will also use them in teaching, or I'll use them with the children. And sometimes I'll write them just generally. But yes, they do appear in sermons. I must say, though, that not all my sermons would be stories. That would be probably the lesser percentage. Straight story. That you can come from all kinds of directions. Yes?
One thing that strikes me is that you put story into such a living pattern for people, like parents with children, etc., that I think is a dimension that we really need. On the other hand, your standard, or you aren't making it the standard, but our standard at this point is very high because we've been exposed to how well you do it. And and I think that, I don't know, what do you suggest?
Oh, I'd like to respond to that. To people who what? I'm sorry, I butted in.
Well, people who want to make this kind of a jump. It's sort of a leap. You haven't done it, it's a leap into something new.
I have a whole bunch of responses, all of them ending up saying, do it. And not foolishly. I do not do that foolishly. Whether you are parents, grandparents, friends, whether you are in a clergy role of some sort or teacher, I say do it. We are an arid society compared to what it used to be for eons and eons. How they held themselves together was by story, and we are arid with our intellectuality and our analytic principles and our fundamental truths being data, empirical data. Do it. Now, what I say is several things. I think most people could do better than they know they could do, and there are several things in their favor. If a parent tells a story to a child, the child never does sit down and say, oh, you didn't say that very well. Because there is a relationship there, the child, and if the parent makes it up, and the parent can make up the most wandering, inartistic story, that's just fine. The child fills it in, the child follows like a puppy, the child finds it a dear thing. All right, so in circumstances where there already is a relationship, listen, people, listen to you when you go to supper tonight. Listen to your conversation at the table. If someone, there'll be six people, is it eight people at a table? If one of you just sits silently and listens to all the others talk, see if you have enough space to count the number of stories that get told at that table. You tell stories all the time. Somebody is going to find out about a hike to Copper Basin today, and they're going to find out with all kinds of dramatic groanings and moanings. It's going to look like a very good story. You do it. That's my second thought. First of all, the relationship fills in your gaps. The second is, but you already do it. You just don't hear yourself. That's the greatest percentage of our conversation is story. The next thing I say, and now when we move to the issue of literally communicating the grace of God in story, and this I have said before, it's on tape from 3 years ago, 2 years, I don't know. I sincerely believe that method follows motive. I do sincerely believe that if you desire much, if you want much to tell this thing, and this thing is one of the profoundest, dearest truths in all the world for you. I believe that if you love God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and that's what you're talking about, that you're going to find a way to say it, and it'll fit you. It won't fit me. You may not jump around and be as dramatic as me. I often think of Than's dad, who speaks very quietly when he's seriously. And he doesn't speak intensely. He speaks quietly. And in the quietness, people respond. It's totally different. I think that if you, number two, love the people you're talking to as you love yourself, and I'm very serious about this, I am not just trying to be idealistic. If you love those that you're talking to, you will find ways to shape what you say and who you are to them. You will look them in the eye because you want them to know this thing. Marvelous, marvelous how parents can become rhetoricians when they have important things to tell their children. Have you ever read, has anyone read Look Homeward Angel? Oh, what a good, there's one. What a good thing you have in store for you. All the good stuff that you have in store for you. In Look Homeward Angel, however, Eugene Gant's dad, this is really Thomas Wolfe's father, when he comes home and works himself into a kind of rhetorical rage, it's marvelous. He goes back and forth in front of the fireplace, and when the fireplace isn't big enough for a backdrop, he takes coal oil. Boom, and he gets fire. And then because his passion is so great, he speaks like he came out of the 16th century. He speaks like he was Shakespeare. I've heard many, many parents, when their passion rises up, use rhetorical devices, use personification, schenectady, oxymorons, all kinds of rhetorical devices, and they do it because they're passionate. And they may not even be happy at the point, at that moment. All right, well, that's a game way of saying a true thing. If you love the people you talk to, and if the thing that you have to say is more significant than anything else, you will say it well. And the story may be frayed, yes, and it may be tattered in spots, yes, but the intensity and the desire of the telling will make that story much better than if you had written down 17 points and explained them one right after the other. Finally, I would say, trust the story form. Now, that's one thing. You know, when I get up and I tell a story, half of it is cheat, people, because half of it isn't me. Half of it is that story works, and you're so willing to work with me on it. Story itself works, and I am now. I've been talking this over with Than and my parents this week, how hungry people are just to hear stories, how really hungry, and that means that the audience is so helpful. When it's not story, when it's intellectual language, that asks you to labor hard, and then you kind of go in and out of that kind of a thing. And that's very important. I don't mean to denigrate intellectual language. Right now, we're just praising story. Is this all to the issue that you asked?
Yeah.
Yeah, so finally, trust the form itself. don't go bonkers on it. I mean, don't stretch it out forever and ever. And finally, the issue is that you're not, I would hope finally the issue is that you're not revealing or focusing upon yourself in a kind of, that's where it fails in the pulpit, I think. When one is just revealing or talking about one's own self and has never really thought through what is the gospel, what is the spiritual context of this thing. I don't think stories should be told in a worship fashion in order just for us all to be friends together or to laugh a little bit or to cry a little bit. That's too thin, and that bothers me. Okay, I went long on that question. Any others?
Hang on the end of that. If a writer doesn't have self-forgiveness, he'll kill it real quick. And I think that is wrapped up. Receptivity and self-forgiveness are crucial in this creative process. The mind does that. That's its nature. That's why we can listen to stories. How
yep.
can I follow something that I shouldn't create? You know?
Yeah.
Yep. And really, my mind is made to walk when you tell a story. And if I have enough trust and richness of the means, you know, in this world, plus self-forgiveness, that I'll pick up a small thing, a small thread, a small image and follow it, as Blake says, you'll get to that heaven's gate in Jerusalem's wall.
Yeah.
Got to have that receptivity, know that the world is lavish with meaning and stories,
yeah.
and that you just start following the thread.
So that you're willing to take the risk,
yeah.
is what it is.
Self-forgiveness, where, you know, writer's block.
I think that the best way around writer's block is trust revision. But I don't use the word self-forgiveness. I think of revision as a forgiveness. I can always come back. I can screw up here, mm-hmm. find the thread, go on, come back,
yeah.
clean it up.
Yeah.
yeah. Absolutely right. Yes.
My husband grew up hearing stories about Willie Greenwood, this little squirrel, from his father when he was little. And he's been telling our two daughters these stories since before they knew what he was doing. And the story will go for two or three weeks every night, and then it'll stop for a month or two. And now it has stopped for a couple of years. But the other day, my daughter said, "Daddy, you haven't told us about Willie Greenwood lately." So he started telling it again. And then she's been telling other people, and I predict that she is going to be a storyteller to her children.
Good. Absolutely. Oh, do I praise that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason, and if you don't make the stories up, read them to your children. But if you can make them up, do definitely make them up. Make them up, because it's their own possession.
Silly, stupid little things, I think. How dumb. But they absolutely love it.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it. If it wasn't so dumb, they might not love it so much.
Right, he's not here.
I was just going to say, I never thought that I could write a story, but I was remembering from when my children were very small that they'd say, "Sing me a song, Mommy."
Uh-huh.
And so I would sing them a song, and really, the songs were the stories.
Story.
Because I knew I could do music, but I didn't think I could tell a story.
Oh, so yeah, that's a good kind of step. You take it in step. So some people draw, son Joseph draws, and his drawings become stories. They really are, even if they're a single picture or if they become a series of pictures. It's common to us. It really is common to us. And if you start with the children, you start with the finest forgivers, the most wondrous audience, and then you begin to discover you can do it. Oh, yeah. Someone, you pointing to someone I'm missing? Is your hand up?
Mine's up.
Oh.
I didn't know somebody else was.
And yours is Eunice?
I'll be good.
Okay.
I was just going to add from last night something that you were saying about being the sort of the mediator, using the story as the mediator almost, the neutral zone between you and a child, for instance, where you
yes.
have difficulty and pain
yeah.
in a community.
Yes.
To me, that's a skill that. I mean, maybe we could get hospitals along with their, you know, when you get ready for birth, go through all the natural childbirth courses, we could start telling you how to tell stories. Because I think there is a big secret in there, a big one, and it opens up communication in an emotional space that's otherwise so tight.
Yes, it does.
I thought it was great that you brought it in that way. And I wish that my own patterns had more, were more disciplined to think, don't say it again, do this, or this is not right, or, you know, don't say that anymore. Go to the story.
Yeah.
And they aren't that well disciplined. It's the extraordinary moment, if I think of, you know, I'll tell you a story.
You know, my image in my head, I don't know if I can even, if there's any parallel, is almost as though you have a world here and two people are on the outside. I mean, they could come around and meet each other here directly, but there's all kinds of shunt and feelings. But they could each enter into the different sides of this world, and then there's something different. And because it's fantasy, it's all play act. It doesn't mean anything. You can risk a whole lot when it doesn't mean anything, except that it means everything. And you can do it without, I mean, you can do it without fears. All of a sudden, you're two different characters acting out a whole different kind of act. And then when you exit that world, and you say, that was a nice story, wasn't it? But you know that there was a reality there that came in a holy moment that you carry into the real world once again. Yes.
I was going to let it go first because I'm not sure you want to answer this question, or you want this question. I really would have run out of time. Do you mind this question?
I don't know yet.
I confess to not having read everything you've written, which I think is like people sitting at the dinner table whispering, I'm not Lutheran. It's like saying, I'm a Methodist, and you had to assure them it was all right. That's a story, too, I think, the story that's told at table. And what I want to ask is, sometimes today, when you talk about story, you have connected it with content, that there is a definable, identifiable content which that story must serve. And the story serves the content, and it has to do with the faith, with the story, the large, the capital S story, with the biblical story, should we say, the story of faith. And I haven't gone further than that. You can say anything you like about that. The question is, when do we talk about, some of when you talk about story, it's story serving a content which can be talked about in other
apart
ways.
Apart from it. That's
sometimes
an, oh,
story,
yeah.
Story, families talk about telling stories.
Right. And sometimes fiction, I think it can, my immediate response, I think you have your finger on something significant, is that story is not always a servant to other content, but that the story is itself the substance. It is the thing
yes,
to be loved. It is the thing which you take a relationship over against. Let me see if I'm on the track.
I'm concerned about what happens when we start out with the end.
I know it. And the meaning. And the meaning. All right, our response.
And there's different modes, I realize. I mean, I'm not saying that as
oh, yeah. We have such variety. But some things need to be written for their own sakes alone. The Book of the Dun Cow was written because I thought I wanted to write an adventure story that would suck people in. They care about the creatures. They care what happened. I wanted to move them, period. I wanted to be a magician. I wanted people to enter into a world that never was and believe it. And along the way, while I wrote it, I knew that I was, it's like a horse. It strikes sparks, but it's really running, okay? You know, you think of Paul Revere's riding. And on the way, I knew that there were sparks. I knew that if I would be as true to existence as possible, there would be truths in there. And those truths, in fact, may be just one truth weaving throughout, but that it wasn't the issue. The issue was to be as true as possible and as exciting as possible. And then when it was published, now I'm going to touch and just agree with you, when it was published, it worked. Except that somebody said I was a pastor. And then when people started asking me about it, they asked for the deep meaning of this, because I was a pastor, and pastors are always dealing with deep meanings. I was on a television show once, and this guy had 2 minutes left to kill. He said, you look like a wise young man. I don't think he didn't read the book. Stop doing this stuff. I think he read it. Pastor. He said, you look like you have a message. This is a quote. A guy in Indianapolis. He said, you look like you have a message for the world. And then he said, what is it? 2 minutes. I had 2 minutes left. Well, now here's the problem. I started believing everybody about the meaning of my book, and when I went on to the next book, The Book of Sorrows, which wasn't called that at that time, I failed miserably on 2 manuscripts. One of the reasons I failed is because I really had something to say to the world at that point. And that's, I think, the point that you're trying to make. I finally had to just cleanse this and get back to the fiction. Get back to the story, make it true, make it enticing. And then it will find its meaning. Now that's different from this stuff. And the nice thing about literature is that we can play it all these various ways, but sometimes, you have a very, very important point there. Sometimes for art, it cannot be the exemplum story, it cannot be a cautionary tale, it cannot be
and
a preachment.
Said, is one which internally...
it found its own.
Found its own. Felt that writing it, that yes. That was a life of its own, the magic of
yeah.
itself. And,
yeah.
not,
and I enjoyed that book a lot, because I was discovering as I wrote it.
Again, you may have made this distinction in what you're doing, but I think it's a fairly interesting distinction, because we use the story, or a fairly necessary distinction. We use the story for both.
Right.
And they're serving different purposes, are created different ways, functioning in different places.
Right.
I think.
Yes.
And I read different ways.
Yes, and somewhere along the line the signal comes that they are different. But and then the world lies in both ways. I think we're time. I have 5 minutes to five.
2 minutes on television.
Oh, man.
You got 2 minutes here.
I fumbled around, and then finally I just said that he looked like a very perceptive man to know this about. That's where I ended. I mean, I had got my hands in the flour. It was one of those long talk shows. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a cook, and I'd stand by the cooking food. And